It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about this afternoon's breaking news that Anthony Scaramucci is out as White House Director of Communications. We catch up on that and other high-profile departures from the Trump administration. First, the White House announced last week that Taiwanese electronic company Foxconn will build a manufacturing plant in southeast Wisconsin and touted that it would bring thousands of jobs to the state. There's excitement around the $10 million Foxconn will invest in Wisconsin, but now there's some wariness, too. The state already pledged $3 billion in financial incentives for the company. On Friday, Governor Walker took the incentives further. He introduced a bill that relaxes the environmental rules that Foxconn would have to follow, which has some conservation groups concerned. Molly Beck is a Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she joins us now to talk about what environmental concessions the bill would make for Foxconn. Molly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Molly, what are some of the environmental rules that Foxconn would get to bypass, according to this bill?
So the bill is aimed at allowing Foxconn to build this plant and campus in a quicker way than having that permit process in place would allow. So some of the provisions that businesses and farm owners have to abide by would be eliminated, including getting permits to build on waterways and waterbeds and discharging materials into wetlands. You have to get permits to do that. And so this bill, it exempts the project from an environmental impact statement, which the DNR conducts for large projects. It would allow the company or its contractors to discharge dredged materials and fill wetlands without state permits, but federal permits would still be required for things like that. It also exempts Foxconn from a requirement that that companies try to avoid filling wetlands when possible, so they could still do that. It lets the company build on riverbeds and lakebeds and connect man-made bodies of water with natural waterways. And, you know, they could change the course of streams or move the stream altogether without getting state permits. And so it's these exemptions that have conservationists concerned.
No, you said there that federal environmental regulations would still apply. So at the federal level, would that cover some of the Wisconsin regulations that would be bypassed? Do we know what exactly would apply at the federal level?
So the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and federal rules that apply to discharging hazardous materials and things like that, all of that would still apply. But it's just a state permitting process to do these things, which some lawmakers who have advocated for changing that process to make it easier for companies to navigate have said it's burdensome and it makes projects go on too long. So I spoke with a Republican state lawmaker today who said that the fact that this bill is exempting Foxconn from those rules is evidence that it needs to be changed.
Sounds like lawmakers will consider the bill as early as Tuesday. Is it looking like it's going to have a pretty smooth passage through?
We'll see. The special session, Governor Walker called a special session that begins on Tuesday, but that doesn't mean that lawmakers will be here on the floor voting on this. What it means is they can be, that's as early as they can to come in and do that. But it sounds like there may be a public hearing on this bill this week or next week. It doesn't sound like they're looking to pass it immediately, as in the next 24 hours, but they will need to move quickly on it because of the memorandum of understanding that Governor Walker signed with the Foxconn chairman. It says that all of this needs to be wrapped up by the end of September.
Now, you mentioned when we started a list of regulations that would be relaxed for Foxconn expressly, with environmental groups having some concerns. Are there any among that list that stand out?
When I talked to conservationists, they didn't have one exemption that was more concerning over another. What they were worried about is that there wouldn't be enough public scrutiny of what's going on because of that permit process wouldn't be in place and because how quickly this all is moving. So So it was kind of the totality of everything in the bill that was concerning.
Now, you also mentioned in a piece you recently wrote about this, some changes to the way Foxconn could behave if it wanted to take up public utility projects. What happens there?
Sure. The bill allows Foxconn to get lower utility rates for at least 10 years and allow power lines to be relocated without state approval. So it exempts the project from having to get approvals that other businesses would have to get from the Public Service Commission.
We're talking to Molly Beck right now, Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. And she's with us now to talk about environmental concessions that the state could make for Foxconn. That's the Taiwanese electronic company that's looking to build a plant in southeast Wisconsin. And Molly, another big piece of this, which has been coming to the forefront, is that the bill also incorporates a transportation project affecting I-94.
Right. Yeah. The bill includes $250 million worth of bonding that would be used to rebuild and expand the I-94 corridor, which, everybody involved has said that that's kind of crucial for this whole project. And that's also been a project that's been debated by lawmakers, and they've, struggled to come to a consensus on how to fund transportation projects, and that's one of the big projects that's involved in that discussion. And so this moves that discussion to this bill, so we'll see.
Right, and as you said, transportation's been a huge sticking point over the last weeks, maybe going on months now, in the legislature. So would this tag on into the bill, looking at that I-94 corridor between Milwaukee and Chicago, does that do anything to loosen some of the people where people are stuck on this, or is this just too specific?
It could. It reduces the amount of bonding that's in play here, and that's been key disagreement between the two Republican caucuses in the Senate and the Assembly. I'm not sure which will be taken up first. I believe it's the Foxconn bill that will be taken up first, and that will, show lawmakers what they have to work with in terms of trying to get an agreement on the rest of the transportation funding projects that have caused the delay in the budget. So we'll see how that plays out.
Now, looking at the big picture here, the tax incentives for Foxconn to come to Wisconsin, the environmental regulations that would be relaxed, is there any concern among lawmakers that other companies based in Wisconsin could look for that same sort of perks and incentivizing for their industries?
Yeah, some lawmakers have said that, this, not so much Wisconsin businesses, but that it could attract other international companies like this one to Wisconsin. What I've heard from lawmakers about existing businesses is, what message does this send to existing businesses that don't receive these kinds of incentives? But this is also, a very unique impact, so to speak, on jobs and tax revenue. So that this is, probably the largest in state history. So there's a difference there too, but I have heard that lawmakers are wondering if this would, pique the interest of other big companies like Foxconn.
Now, Foxconn is known for manufacturing iPhones in China, and in Wisconsin, it sounds like they'd be making liquid crystal display screens for computers and TVs and things like self-driving cars. In other parts of the world where Foxconn already has a presence, what is their reputation?
Well, I know a few years ago, I believe it was around 2010 or 2011, there was a lot of reports about employees there being so unhappy that there were a number of suicides. And I know that the company also has been criticized for its what they do there is affecting the environment. But those concerns seem to have subsided in recent years. I believe that some of those things that were happening there, they've moved to rectify. So that seems to have, those concerns have lessened or gone away.
Now, when we talk about the potential of thousands of new jobs coming to the Wisconsin economy, do we know what kinds of jobs we're talking about?
Yeah, there was a a study that Foxconn commissioned last week. They kind of laid out what kind of jobs they were looking at, and most of them would be, people there assembling the LCD panels. There would also be engineers and people working in the business office and things like that. But the company also expects to create a number of indirect, quote-unquote, jobs because of just the plant's existence. And an example of that would be 400 jobs at a glass manufacturer that would need to be nearby the plant. So they think that they will be able to create 35,000 jobs statewide just coming here, and 13,000 of those would be actually at the plant that has not been located for yet.
Thanks a lot, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, Capital reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joining us to talk about the environmental concessions that the state would make for Foxconn to come to Wisconsin, and also looking at some changes to transportation. Summer in Wisconsin is a great time to get out on the water, and our next guest has advice about where to paddle in Wisconsin. From inland lakes to rivers big and small, Wisconsin has a lot to offer when it comes to paddling. Kevin Revelinsky joins us now. He's an outdoors and travel writer from Madison and the author of several Wisconsin guidebooks, including Paddling Wisconsin. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Kevin, if you're a beginner, either in maybe a kayak or a canoe, what's a safe but still kind of a fun place to try taking to the water for the first time?
Well, certainly lakes are the best place to start to get comfortable in the kayak or the canoe. Because if you spill, you're not going to be swept away, presumably.
That makes sense.
But even gentle rivers are nice to get on. I think beginners have even gotten on, bigger rivers like the Wisconsin, which, you do have to be careful about. But if you go on a trip or with other experienced people, it really isn't, intimidating.
So for newbies, if you're considering, do I want to try a kayak or a canoe when I want something that's going to be stable for my first time, what do you pick? Can you walk us through kind of the differences there?
Well, in a canoe, I think it feels less stable because you're higher up out of the water. And it'll rock a little bit when you adjust and you think, oh, my God, I'm going over, kind of like
there,
that chair that isn't going to topple backwards, but it feels like it is. But, once you get comfortable with it and you find your positioning there, it's really more stable than you think. The kayak is closer to the water, but some people might not be comfortable. Well, depending on the kayak, there are sit atop kayaks and also sit in, and the longer, well, there's a variety of them, let's say.
Yeah.
So some people feel trapped when they're in them because it kind of comes around you if it's one of the traditional styles, whereas the sit atop you could bail out if you had to, and you're kind of out there in the open. I think people like to fish in those, and it's a good beginner summery kind of experience too.
So do you feel like, is it one of those things where a kayak is more like a sports car where you kind of feel the road, and the canoe you don't feel the water as much?
Well, it's different, certainly. I think you feel it either way. Personally, I love going down faster rivers in a canoe because I can kind of see further ahead. But then, you are closer to the water, and you do really feel, one with the rush when you're in that kayak, so...
Now, you brought us a lot of ideas about places to go in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is, I haven't paddled in a lot of other states, but it seems like Wisconsin is kind of a playground because there's so many options for paddling here.
There are so many lakes. We used to, tease Minnesota about the 10,000 lake state because we've got something like 12,500. they actually have more than that, but whatever. And we have so many miles of rivers, and anything that's unobstructed, you can paddle it. You can go through the city of Milwaukee on the river, which I think is kind of neat. So you've got urban paddling. The lakes here in Madison, the White River up outside of Ashland is a nice little trout stream that when you go way up towards the headwaters, you can almost reach across it. You couldn't put the canoe sideways on it. It's so narrow. But, it's a nice little paddle through the woods in the swamp. So,
well, let's talk about that urban paddling. You mentioned, I know you said there was an 8-mile stretch, and I'm guessing this is the Kinnekinnick River near Milwaukee. Is that right?
No,
is that where it is?
I'm thinking of the actual Milwaukee River coming down.
Oh, the actual Milwaukee River. Okay.
Yeah. And
where do you get in there?
downriver of Estabrook Park. But now, I haven't been there recently, and I know they had plans to take out the dam there, so they may have actually even taken that out, in which case you can paddle much further. But anywhere above North Avenue there are a couple put-in places, and the Urban Ecology Center is a nice place, I think, to get in and paddle all the way downtown.
Wow. Well, how would you describe the difference between urban, kind of semi-urban, because you're still in a river and you're moving through and you're looking at some wildlife, but how would you describe the difference between urban paddling and somewhere where you're out, you know, farther from civilization?
Well, in the spots where you can't see the city because of the trees around you, you feel like you're in this little secret garden setting, you know? And there is one little shoot of rapids in Milwaukee that kind of goes under the North Street, I guess it is, bridge. And it's remarkable. It's surprising, I guess, is what I like about it. And then you can also get out and take a break and get some food. It's right there, you know, at the side of the river. But I think it's the surprise and looking up at the buildings from a different angle you've never seen before.
We're talking to Kevin Revelinsky right now, an outdoors and travel writer from Madison and the author of several Wisconsin guidebooks, including Paddling Wisconsin. That's what we're talking about right now, places to paddle in the state now that it's summertime. And Kevin, we got to talk about the Great Lakes. I know there's great kayaking, especially on the Great Lakes. I don't know if you want to take a canoe. It's a little more tippy, but tell us about the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore.
That is one of the most fantastic paddling experiences you can have, I think, in Wisconsin. It does demand something a little sturdier than your recreational kayak. You would have a sea kayak in that case, and a spray skirt around you to keep the water that you're, you know, of the waves and also from paddling from getting into your craft. And it's cold water, of course, so you want to be warm. But paddling out from Myers Beach there along the lakeshore to the what they call sea caves, even though it's, you know, a lake, but it is the Great Northern Sea, they say, and there are caves and tunnels that you can paddle through, and it's just absolutely gorgeous and dramatic. I mean, the weather can change in a heartbeat, and you're paddling back to shore and wading it out and going back out again because it, you know, suddenly the water was calm again. So, you know, it's really an awesome experience, and most people, especially anyone who's not experienced, is going to do that with an outfitter like Living Adventure up in Bayfield.
What is a sea kayak? What's the difference between that and what I rented this weekend on a little Madison lake?
Well, they're longer generally, and many of them will have rudders, and you're able to put a skirt on them to keep that water out, and they track very nicely, you know, so you can paddle straight long distances, whereas these recreational ones don't really do that as well. And definitely the whitewater ones don't at all, because you don't want to track when you're in a situation you want to steer very quickly. So they're good for long distance paddling and certainly in rougher waters like that.
Now, I know a lot of people enjoy the sandbar camping thing where you're on the river and you stop and you camp overnight and paddle somewhere the next day. I've never done it. Tell us about what that's like.
Well, it's great because you just choose your site as you go along. You find something that's vacant on the Wisconsin River, and you can, you know, put up your tent and you know, go from sandbar to sandbar over the course of several days. Years ago, I did about a 5-day trip, and we did the last 92 miles before the Mississippi. And the very last night, I mean, this is something I supposed to be aware of, sandbars are not permanent. We had a lovely thunder and rainstorm, and woke up and had about a third of our sandbar was missing on the downriver side. But yeah, well, there's that darker side to sandbar
camping. Okay, so there could have been a situation there. Yeah. What did you, was that with all your stuff okay?
And yeah, everything was
nothing
fine.
Floated away downriver?
We had our stuff with us and kept an eye on it when it started raining really hard. So
it sounds like maybe that's something, again, you might want a little more experience under your belt before you try.
Maybe. Somebody needs to know what they're doing in the group for sure. But it shouldn't intimidate anyone, I don't think. And there are other rivers that have camping along the river, and you don't have to worry about your sandbar. For example, the St. Croix and Namekagon up north, and also upper stretches of the Wisconsin as well. And those are free campsites that are managed either by nationally or by the state.
So have you had some pretty good wildlife viewing experiences from the water? I imagine that's one way. I've heard about people seeing otters out on the boats. What have you seen?
I have seen an otter, which is, for me, was very thrilling, and that was on the Wapaka River. It had a little fish in its mouth, and it hopped over a downed tree and kept swimming. It was great.
Nice.
Lots of deer, of course. They come to the water to drink, and in the morning you catch them with their heads down, and they don't see you until you're upon them. Because, you know, it's a silent sport if you're not paddling. So, yeah.
I know one other favorite. I don't know if there are any otters there or not. The Kickapoo River.
The Kickapoo. I don't know if there's otters there either. But it is one of the more popular paddling destinations, I think, because it's so interesting. You know, it's they say it's the windiest river, I guess ever. But it goes back and forth on itself. And covers far more ground than it does, you know, in a line on a map. So, and sandstone cliffs, lots of wildlife. I've seen owls out there, deer, of course, eagles.
That sounds great. Well, if people are listening, they haven't done this yet, they want to give it a try. What do people need to know before they head out?
Well, you do need to be, the word of advice, of course, you have to have your personal flotation device at any time you go into the rivers, I think. And the advice is be ready to swim whatever you're paddling, because it could happen. Likely it won't if you're careful. But
has it happened to you?
It has happened to me. And it was usually something really dummy and foolish. It wasn't a dangerous in any manner, but it was an unexpected, here's a rock and you just tipped. Oh, whoops. And you're standing there up to your waist in the water, and there goes your things floating down the
All right,
the
so
river.
Be ready for anything. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us. This is Kevin Revelinsky, outdoor and travel writer from Madison, the author of several books, including Paddling Wisconsin, and he joined us to talk about the best places to paddle in the state. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Milwaukee's open housing marches, which put the city and the issue of housing segregation at the forefront of the civil rights movement. The NAACP Youth Council organized 200 consecutive days of demonstrations in support of fair housing legislation. In 1968, the Common Council approved a bill outlawing discrimination in selling and renting homes. But half a century later, Milwaukee remains one of the most segregated cities in the country. Reggie Jackson joins us now. He's an oral historian and head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. Reggie, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, the fight for fair housing in Milwaukee goes back to at least 1962, when Alderwoman Vel Phillips started introducing fair housing bills to the Common Council. Can you tell us about what conditions she was trying to address for African Americans living in Milwaukee?
For the most part, at that particular time, blacks were stuck in one part of the city, the central part of the city, just north of downtown, an area that had been basically the oldest housing stock in the city, a place where they'd tried to move out of. They've expanded a little bit to the west, but they weren't able to move south or east in the city at all. So they were attempting to move to other parts of the city that had newer homes.
So those first efforts of Vel Phillips to introduce fair housing legislation, they failed. So when did the issue come to a head for African Americans in Milwaukee and beyond, and result in these marches 50 years ago?
Well, they began to kind of address the issue of why the rest of the Common Council wouldn't even consider a discussion about Vel Phillips' bill. And so she became involved with the NAACP, and they began to work together to raise awareness of the issue, to begin to protest at the homes of aldermen, and also to get out into the streets and begin to plan marches. And so the marches that they put together in August of 1967, which lasted all the way through 1968, were their greatest effort to raise awareness of the fact that blacks couldn't occupy any spaces on the south side of the city in particular.
Can you talk a little bit about why housing segregation in the 60s was such an important issue for Milwaukee's black leaders?
Yes, you know, segregation, contrary to what most of us believe, is not something that happens naturally. It happens at the behest of the federal government, who began to intervene in the 1930s and really demand that new communities be segregated. So they basically proposed to new communities that they use racial restrictive covenants to keep African Americans out of specific neighborhoods and keep those neighborhoods as white as possible. And so when you look at Milwaukee County, the 18 suburbs of Milwaukee County use these racial restrictive covenants extensively, and 16 of the 18 use them. Only Oak Creek and River Hills didn't have racial restrictive covenants. And what it basically did was it kept those communities very white. And even if you look today, if you look at the 19 cities in Milwaukee County, there are only three outside of the city of Milwaukee that have an African American population above 5%.
I want to talk about the demonstrations. There were 200 consecutive days of demonstrations, and some of these marches, I mean, they began small, but they really built, and there were counter protesters on the other side, and they were quite a moment in Milwaukee's history. Can you take us to those days, what it was like?
Yes, absolutely. So when they began the march across the 16th Street Viaduct to the south side, the initial march, the first time they did it, they were met by a group of counter-protesters who were angry that they were coming to that part of the city. And so they were yelling angry things at them, racial epithets, things of that nature. And, you know, they got through it that first night. When they came back the second night, the counter-protesters were much, much larger. They estimate that probably about 5,000 counter-protesters were there that second time. And they were much more angry than they were the night before. They were throwing bottles, rocks, racial epithets. You know, many of the people who were in the march got separated from the other members of the march. There was not a large enough police presence to really protect them. And it really became very hazardous for those marchers, but they decided to fight through it and continue marching, and did so for 200 consecutive days. And the longer they did it, the smaller the counter-protesters group became. And after a while, they would very rarely even see any counter-protesters.
You mentioned police officers there. What role did the police officers play? I mean, these days there is a tension between police officers sometimes and minority communities that we're seeing playing out over the past couple of years. What was it like then?
Well, there's been bad relations between the black community and the Milwaukee Police Department for an extended period of time. Going back to the 1950s and 60s, there were several high-profile cases where blacks were killed by the police. And so even if we look at what happened just recently last year in Sherman Park, a lot of the civil unrest in Milwaukee is seen, including the civil unrest of 1967, has been related to police activity. And we need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, there are a lot of other factors that are related to that. That helped us to have the unrest in Sherman Park last year. You know, the economic situation, the loss of high-quality jobs, the lack of programming for young people in the community, all built on top of just a really considered a very respectful treatment, disrespectful treatment by the Milwaukee Police Department. All of those things kind of came together in Sherman Park last year and led to that explosion.
And we're talking with Reggie Jackson right now, head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. And we're talking about the city's marches for fair housing in 1967 and what housing looks like for African Americans in that city 50 years later. And Reggie, we haven't yet talked about Father James Groppi. He was maybe an unlikely leader of those marches and was on the front lines of the protests with the NAACP Youth Council. And we have a clip of him here after a march that was met with violent opposition.
We have tried every means possible to bring fair housing legislation to the city of Milwaukee. And we're going to continue to march. It's up to the government of this city and of this state to see to it that we can exercise our constitutional right of freedom of speech. And we're going to exercise that, regardless of what the danger. We'll die for that right.
That was Father James Groppi, a white Roman Catholic priest. How did he become so crucial to these demonstrations?
Well, you know, Father Groppi had been a supporter of open housing in Milwaukee, kind of on the sidelines for a while, and he became actively involved as the movement grew. And he decided that it was his place to step in and speak for those people who were protesters, because they weren't many people from the white community who were speaking on their behalf. So he decided that he would make his voice known, and he became accepted by the NAACP Youth Council and the other members that were protesting, including Alderwoman Vale Phillips. And they grew a very strong bond between themselves and Father Grappi, and, you know, he became one of the leaders of that activity, trying to prevent people from moving to the South Side. He was very adamant that it made no sense whatsoever that people couldn't live where they wanted to live.
And did the movement in general at that time, besides Father Grappi, did it have other allies among the white community in Milwaukee?
There were some, but for the most part, they were pretty quiet. People were afraid because if we remember in 1967, there had been the civil unrest that summer as well, just a couple months before the marches took place. So that civil unrest in the martial law that was declared in the city by the mayor, that really kind of turned a lot of whites off in terms of their support of the movement. And so they really, for the most part, as a result of that, they kind of had to go at it alone without many white compatriots at that particular time. There were some, but not a great deal.
So moving forward a bit in time, in 1968, President Johnson signed a National Fair Housing Act, and the Milwaukee Common Council then followed suit by passing an even stronger law of their own. What did that Milwaukee law say?
It basically said that it was against the law to discriminate in housing, that people should be able to live where they wanted to live. The federal law actually outlawed a few things that really helped to create segregation. It outlawed the use of racial restrictive covenants. It outlawed the use of redlining. And, you know, it put a thing in place that people could finally go to actually file formal complaints about housing discrimination on the local level as well as the national level. However, on the federal level, Mitt Romney's dad, George Romney, was in charge of housing and urban development, and he was really a big proponent of that new law. He created a program they call Open Communities, which demanded that any community that was still practicing segregation would be denied federal funds for any project. So whether it be road projects, power projects, water projects, any of those. And President Nixon got word of that, and he basically killed that program almost immediately. And Mr. Romney ended up leaving housing and urban development. And so there were mechanisms in place to fight housing discrimination, but they weren't used very forcefully. And as a result, we continue to have a tremendous amount of segregation. Even a census that was done in 1975 showed that on the south side of Milwaukee, the numbers of blacks who had actually moved there after the marches were still very, very low. In most of those neighborhoods, they were in the single digits.
So the laws that passed at the federal and the state level and city level in Milwaukee, those were not, it sounds like, a complete victory even at the time.
Yeah, they were kind of a victory in terms of the fact that people have been fighting to actually have those laws placed on the books. But the problem with them was the enforcement mechanism behind them wasn't strong enough that it curtailed, people continuing to discriminate. Even to this day, there's still a mechanism in place that people just aren't aware of, that they can file housing discrimination complaints. In many cases, people will go and hire private attorneys to do the work for them instead of going through the government.
Well, Reggie, I want to fast forward to the present day. Milwaukee, still one of the most segregated cities in the country, even when compared with other cities and regions that were lagging behind in terms of lingering segregation. What's going on in Milwaukee?
Well, probably the biggest factor that makes our region the most segregated is the fact that African Americans don't live in the suburbs or exurban counties here. If you look at Milwaukee County, only about 6% of African Americans in Milwaukee County live in the suburbs, and that's a very low rate as compared to some other very big cities. Even some cities that are pretty segregated, like Chicago and Cleveland, have a much higher percentage of blacks in the suburbs. And so that's one of the factors. As blacks tried to move out to the suburbs in the 60s and early 70s, when the jobs were still readily abundant here and, you know, high-quality family-supporting jobs, when they could actually afford to move to those communities, they weren't allowed to. And then as the economy started to change and those jobs went away and people aren't making as much money today as they were then, then now they can't afford to live in those communities. It's too expensive. So when they had the money to move there, they weren't allowed to because of, you know, different things that were in place. And as they gained, you know, an ability to move there, it simply isn't viable for many people now because they can't afford to. Even blacks who have the money to move to the suburbs still primarily live in the central part of the city. We have the highest percentage of blacks of higher income living in concentrated poverty neighborhoods. I think the only city that's worse is Detroit, Michigan.
Talking with Reggie Jackson right now, head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, talking about the city's marches for fair housing in 1967 and what housing looks like for minorities in that city 50 years later. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Reggie about the open housing marches or housing in the city of Milwaukee today? Is housing segregation a problem where you live, whether it's in Milwaukee or elsewhere? And if you took part, maybe in those marches 50 years ago, do you have memories of them? How do you feel about where the city stands now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and right now we're picking up a conversation with Reggie Jackson of America's Black Holocaust Museum about the marches of protest that protested housing segregation in Milwaukee 50 years ago and why the city remains so segregated today. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What are your memories of Milwaukee's fair housing marches in 1967? And looking now at the city 50 years later, do you think that that movement made a difference? Have you seen housing segregation impact your life, your area where you live? And what steps do you think are needed to address those stark divides that we still see in urban areas? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to our callers right now. We've got Andy with us first in Price County. Andy, hi.
Hey, hi.
What do you want to share?
Yeah, I in 67, I was, I'm 64 years old now, but I was a student at Riverside High School. And
in Milwaukee.
Yeah, on the east side of Milwaukee there. And we had some friends with the Socialist Workers Party. And they came by with the van, and they picked a few of us up, and we went over to Father Grappi's church. I think that was St. Benedict's, and we went on a few marches, and it was fun walking and singing. And then when you get to the other end of the bridge, and the hatred that was coming back was pretty intense. Yes, it was.
So you remember it to this day? Do you feel like it made a difference as someone who took part in this?
Well, I haven't lived in Milwaukee for quite a while, but apparently, you know, in spite of the efforts, no, that doesn't seem like a lot of progress. But it's nice that people can get together and try to make a change.
And Andy, did you stay involved in that movement at all after 1967, that era we're talking about?
Well, through my years in high school after that, yeah, I was there till I left Milwaukee in about 70 or 71, I guess, and I haven't lived there in the city much since then. I have spent a good bit of time in working in the South since then, and it's interesting to see some comparisons and similarities in certain places.
Andy, thanks a lot for calling and sharing those memories. And Reggie, Andy was there for at least a few marches there he's talking about, and remembering, he says, the vitriol and the hate.
Yeah, you know, that was something I think that came as a shock to some people, to see that in Milwaukee. We typically think of that type of hatred being something that was more common in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. It was very common here in Milwaukee as well. You know, one of the things that we didn't have, we had segregation in Milwaukee. We had segregated spaces. We just didn't have signs, you know, designating spaces for blacks or whites only. But we did have, you know, segregated seating in different places. We had certain, you know, restaurants and hotels that wouldn't allow blacks to be a customer at all. In fact, during the heyday of Milwaukee's Black Entertainment District, we had famous musicians and singers that would come to the city, and they weren't allowed to stay in most of the hotels in the city. They actually stayed in private residences that Black people owned in the city.
Andy, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. And let's go next to Matthew in Waukesha County. Matthew, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. So I grew up, I spent the first few years until eighth grade in MPS, and then I my parents moved out to the suburbs. So something I want to ask is why this isn't something that we learn about in our education. I didn't even hear about the Fair Housing Act until my senior year of college. So I guess, what do you think? Maybe if people knew more about this past and kind of the reality of how segregation got so bad in Wisconsin, or I guess in Milwaukee, that, you know, things would be different now? Or
Matthew, thank you. I appreciate that. He's wondering why this hasn't been talked about more. I wonder if that's starting to change. What do you think, Reggie?
Yeah, it's absolutely changing. I think that's a great question that he asked about why we don't learn it. Part of the reason we don't is simply there's certain parts of our history that we tend to ignore. Those ugly parts of our history we don't like to talk about in our history classes. And I've been doing a series of talks, presentations that I call The Hidden Impact of Segregation here locally. So I've done it in several places in Milwaukee. I just did it out in Mequon last week. I did it in Waukesha. So I've been spreading this information about how segregation developed, the mechanisms behind it, the impacts of it. And it's been very well attended by people at all of the venues that I've been at, whether it be libraries, schools, whatever. I think people are very interested in how we became the most segregated city. I think they're tired of hearing that we're the most segregated city, and I think they want to do something about it. And I think the first step in that process is to learn how we became the most segregated community and look at what that's actually done to the community. Because in addition to segregation, you have concentrated poverty, which has become part of the norm in Milwaukee. And so with those two combined together, it makes it very difficult for people who are living in those impoverished communities to get outside of those spaces. And it impacts the schools. It impacts everything within the city. Typically, people who live outside the city, even in the suburbs and the exurban counties, they don't recognize that it has an impact on their communities as well, because we have to pay large amounts of money because of the level of poverty we have in the city of Milwaukee.
And Reggie, what do you think is needed today in order to start making the vision that those marchers had 50 years ago of making Milwaukee a less segregated city a reality?
Well, I think the first thing is just people opening up their communities and welcoming people to their communities from different groups that they're not accustomed to being around. I always, in my presentations on the hidden impact of segregation, by telling the groups that you have to be willing to take down some of the barriers that are in place to prevent people of color from moving into communities that are very white. In addition to that, there are still several suburban communities around Milwaukee that have zoning laws that really prevent any low-income housing from being built there. And so as long as those zoning laws remain the same, you're going to not have many low-income people, with the exception of elderly people, living in those communities. And so those two things, I think, are important. And also just having people be more cognizant of the fact that we have the open housing law, but it's not strongly enforced, and making it more of an issue for our elected officials to bring forth, enforcement of it in the way that it was intended when they first created the law.
Reggie, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That was Reggie Jackson, head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum, talking with us there about residential segregation in Milwaukee 50 years after the city's marches for fair housing. And you can find an article about this on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, share your thoughts with us. What are your memories of those marches in 1967? And do you think Milwaukee could or needs to do more to address housing issues today? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
A Excuse me. Who are you?
Rubeus Hagrid, keeper of keys and grounds at Hogwarts. Of course, you'll know all about Hogwarts.
Sorry, no.
No? Blimey, Harry, didn't you ever wonder where your mum and dad learned it all?
Learned what?
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard. And a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
Big happy birthday is in order today for the boy who lived. That's right. Today is the birthday of everybody's favorite boy wizard, definitely mine, Harry Potter. As things add up, that would mean that Harry Potter would be 37 years old today in the Hogwarts universe, which means maybe, you know, he'd have some kids. Maybe he'd be an Auror now, or maybe a teacher at Hogwarts, like Severus Snape. Well, what do you think Harry Potter becomes when he grows up? We have no way of knowing, of course, since J.K. Rowling hasn't written that far into Harry's story, but it's always fun to think about. You can let us know. What do you think Harry would be up to when he reached the ripe old age of 37? You can let us know your thoughts and celebrate Harry Potter's birthday over on the Central Time Facebook page.